a pizza delivery kid backed his car, had his huge jump us into the driveway of my neighbor. You know how sometimes they're a little sloppy getting parked. And he got out of the car, and he tripped over something, and he fell, pizzas and all, right on the rose bush, and really did a lot of damage to those pizzas. And to himself, and to that rose bush. And he was so flummoxed by all of this that he got into his vehicle and back out of the yard as fast as he could go, driving right over the rose bush. And you know what? The next spring, that rose bush came back to life, grew, thrived, and had roses. And you could say that that rose bush was pretty hardy to be able to endure all of this stuff. And if you said that, you'd probably be right in some vernacular sense, but you wouldn't be right as a gardener unless what the rose bush really had done was survive the cold winter. Because we recall, to gardeners, hardy means the ability to tolerate cold. Now, plants are rated on their ability to tolerate cold. Some plants don't tolerate cold very well at all. They probably naturally came from warm places where it never got very cold, but because we bring things into the trade and sell them commercially, we're likely to have available to us plants that are native to warm places and are brought here where it's perhaps not quite warm enough to make them happy. Or if we're ordering from a catalog and we say, oh, that's a nice looking plant, I'd like to have it in my garden, it's terribly important that you check its hardiness rating to be sure that if you plant it in your garden, it's not going to freeze to death in the first winter. So plants are rated by how cold a winter they can tolerate. They're rated for hardiness by how cold a winter they can tolerate. And how cold a winter they can tolerate is described by geographic places in the world, and for us here in the United States, it's described by geographic places in the United States. So the United States, Canada, Mexico, and anywhere else for that matter, that's been studied a little bit like this, is divided up into hardiness zones. And a part of the world is in the same hardiness zone if the average minimum temperatures in the wintertime are all within the same range. Now, we can divide the country into hardiness zones that are kind of broad ranges of minimum winter temperatures. Zone A is a cold zone. It's up there in the northern part of our state. Tends to go across parts of the country that get really cold in the winter. And then there's Zone B, which is down a little bit farther. Most of us here in Michigan are in there. Zone C is a little farther down, and some really warm places are down there in Zone D. So if you look in your guide, you'll see that some plants are rated for their hardiness with the letter A, B, C, D. And that's saying what geography, what geographic places you can plant these plants and expect them to be able to survive the cold winter. Now, one of the things that plants have to do right in order to survive the cold winter, they have to be able to tell when the cold winter is over. That's why, if you're a gardener like me, it might feel pretty nice to have a few warm days like this in February. But all is not right with the world. This is too warm for February. If this continues for very much longer, plants are going to get fooled. They're going to think that it's spring. They're going to come out, start to try to grow, and it's very likely that we'll have at least one more killing frost before spring is really, really here. So this kind of weather is likely to be hard on plants. It's especially likely to be hard on plants if the plants aren't already used to a hard winter if they're used to a few days like this, indicating that springtime is ready, or if they come out a little bit early and get hit with some cold weather that's still yet to come, plants that are very good at tolerating cold will be less damaged than plants that aren't so good at tolerating cold. Now, sometimes we grow plants in our home landscapes that we've chosen from somewhat warmer climes. They're near the northern limit of their hardiness tolerance. There might be a zone C plant that we're trying to squeeze in here into zone B, and most winters we'll be able to get away with it, and some winters we might not be able to get away with it. But if we're cagey, knowledgeable gardeners, there are things that we can do that will make it more likely that we get away with it, that we enable our plant to grow even though it's pushing the envelope of the limits of hardiness and cold tolerance. Now, we can take a page out of little animals' books as gardeners and learn something about how to survive a cold winter, especially a cold winter that's likely to have a few premature thaws like we're experiencing right now. If we're a tree or a shrub or a bush that isn't very tolerant of freezing weather, especially once we start to grow, we break our dormancy, we dissolve the ethylene glycol that we've stuck into ourselves to resist freezing, or we reinstall the liquid that's in the phloem and xylem that's moving around inside of us. We've started to grow again. We're much more susceptible to frost damage than if we were still packaged up, more or less dormant, hibernating, as it were, getting through the cold winter. So let's look at a little animal that's going to hibernate through the cold winter. Here's the badger. It's going to dig a hole somewhere and crawl in there and sleep until it's time to come out. Now, the badger could pick a nice, warm, sunny slope, south-facing, to dig his hole. Or he could pick a slope that faced east, that got the morning sunshine, to dig his hole. Or he could dig his hole on a west-facing slope to get the afternoon sun. Or he could dig his hole on the north-facing slope so that he didn't get any sun at all. And we could just think for a little bit about where he wants to dig his hole. He knows, and she knows, where to dig the hole, and they do it quite predictably and quite reliably. They want to dig the hole on the north-facing slope. They want to dig the hole on the north-facing slope because the north-facing slope is the last direction to warm up in the spring. It gets the least amount of direct sun, so it's likely to stay frozen longer. The south-facing slope is going to warm up right away when we get one of these thaws with the sun beating down on it. And the west slope will warm up a little bit sooner. The east slope gets the morning sun when it's still cool, so it won't warm up quite so quick. But that north-facing slope, it's least likely to warm up prematurely, and by the time the ground around the hole in which the little animal is hibernating warms up, the little animal is pretty sure that if it comes out, it's not going to get its tail frozen. So if we have a magnolia tree that we're trying to grow in our gardens because we really like magnolia trees, but it really comes from a little farther south, and it's really growing here a little bit farther north than it's likely to be able to survive, which side of our house should be planted on? The north or the... If the north side of our house was smack up against a condo, what would be the second best bet? East, east, east. Good. Now, do we have to check when we plant annuals to see whether they're hardy or not? No. Good, courageous no coming right out here. No. Why not? Annuals spend the winter in a seed packet in your cupboard. So it's only perennial plants that have a hardiness rating. Now, if you looked in the houseplant section of our guide, would we expect to see hardiness ratings? Another courageous voice somewhere? No, no. Because these plants are going to spend the winter where? In your house. I may have misspelled that, as you know, I'm a past master at misspelling things. These are the plants that are not annuals, and basically they're not house plants either. These are the plants that need to live through a winter outdoors. Now, in the trade, we have a very narrow meaning for perennials, and we have a more broader, more botanical meaning for perennials. The broader, more botanical meaning for perennials is plants that live for more than 1 year, and it's in contrast with annuals. So things like trees and bushes would be perennials in the botanical sense. But gardeners and the trade have a more narrow view of what is meant by a perennial. We have a kind of special, narrow meaning of perennial. A perennial is a plant whose above ground parts are annual, but the below ground parts survive for many years. So a perennial, in the narrow sense, in the sense of the commercial trade, is a plant like a peony that isn't there in the wintertime unless you left the dead leaves lying on the ground where it grew last year. The only part that's there and alive during the winter is the part underground. And then in the spring, the perennial grows above ground, and whatever it does up there. And then in the fall, when frosts come, the above ground part dies down and it makes it through the winter underground. The perennials in this narrow commercial sense have hardiness ratings. Yes, they have to make it through the winter outdoors, buried in the ground. Now, what could you do to your perennial to help it get through the winter? Mulch it. Why would you want to mulch it? Keep it warm is the immediate, imagined, possible reason, but that would be wrong. But I thank Sven for offering that to us so that we can discuss it. Thank you, Sven. What we're really trying to do, it's just like the magnolia tree that we planted on the north side of the house. Why did we put that on the north side of the house? We wanted to keep it cold. So when we put a big, thick layer of leaves over where our peony came out of the ground last spring, that big, thick layer of leaves is to keep the ground where the peony is trying to get through the winter, cold. Layer of thermal resistance to keep the ground cold. In fact, if the ground freezes, the water in the ground, what's the water in the ground do? Expands. And then when the ground melts, what's the water in the ground do? Dribbles down into the cracks. There's some more cracks up at the top. That fills in with water that's running around on the surface of your yard. When that freezes, it expands again. And if we have two or three of these freeze-thaw cycles during the winter, it will heave the roots of your peony or whatever other, quote, perennial you might have in the ground right up out of the ground, where it will really freeze or come to other harm. So we mulch the perennials not only to keep them cold, but to protect them from frost heaving. Trees are sometimes part of our landscape. Do trees have hardiness ratings? Yes, trees have hardiness ratings because they live for many, many years. They're sitting out there, taking the cold. They have hardiness ratings. Trees are very special creatures on our landscape. Trees are likely to be very, very old. Some of them might be young little things you just planted, but especially big trees are likely to be old. They're likely to carry with them a sense of history. They're likely to carry with them a sense of permanence, a sense of awe. A lot of the aesthetics that we associate with the plants in our landscape are represented by trees. Trees also take a very long time to get to be trees, so we can't stick trees in and pull trees out wherever we want them like we can annuals. That's one of the outstanding advantages of gardening with annuals, is you really have a lot of power and prerogative to stick them wherever you want. But a tree takes a long time to become a tree, and so there it is. Now there's some good things about a tree. Because trees take such a long time, and because they can be so majestic and carry such a sense of history and make such a basic part of the structural aspects of your landscape, we want to be very reluctant in general to cut down trees or remove trees from our landscape. However, there are some reasons why we might want to remove a tree, or we might want to not let a tree get started in the wrong place, or we might want to remove some of a tree. Trees are very big plants, but what's particularly relevant about a tree that we may not be fully aware of is that trees are often as big or nearly as big underground as they are above ground. Typically, trees have lots of leaf surface, especially compared to a little tiny plant. And most plants that have lots of leaf surface evaporate lots of water. So a big tree is able to suck lots of water out of the ground all around it. Typically, the roots of a tree extend outward at least as far as the branches extend outward. So if we have a tree growing in our garden, right underneath the tree, there's likely to be an unfair competition for water between the tree and anything else you plant there. So we need to be aware that the tree is making a huge demand on the water supply, and being a big, powerful plant, it has the muscle to demand, quote, more than its share of water. Trees' roots start out as little tiny things that grow at the end, and they're exploring around, trying to find water and nutrients and space. And then, as they grow, they get bigger and bigger around, until pretty soon, they're bigger around than they were before. Now, ordinarily, this is a good thing. But if the tree finds the foundation of your house and puts some of its little roots in there, and then later they get bigger around, the foundation of your house begins to crumble, and that's not cool. So we don't want trees to grow too close to the foundation of our house. Trees are also very good at finding your sewerage drains. What is there in a sewerage drain that a tree would really like to be able to find? Water, but most especially, nutrients. And then the tree fills your sewage drain full of roots, and your sewage drain doesn't drain anymore. When trees are too close to your house, their branches hang out over your roof, and perhaps they drop lots of leaves, if they're a deciduous tree, on your roof. And these fill up your eaves troughs, so the water doesn't drain off your roof anymore. Or the tree reaches so far over your roof that it gets on top of your chimney. What happens then? The chimney doesn't draw the way it was designed to. The smoke doesn't rise up out of your chimney in accordance with the aerodynamics that your chimney was designed to stimulate. So your fireplace starts to back up and fill your house full of smoke, or your furnace stops working properly. It's really important to trim tree branches that have actually physically gone too close or even over your chimney, away from your chimney. Sometimes when tree branches are very close to your roof or even lying down on your roof, especially if you have asbestos shingle over plywood type roof, which is quite common in our part of the world, the tree will prevent your roof from drying out in between rainstorms, and your roof will start to rot. Now, right next to your house is a very common place for trees to start to grow, ironically enough. And why is that? Anybody have an idea why trees start to grow spontaneously right where we don't want them? Sounds like a good idea. I can't hear it though. There's more shelter of a very special kind. Perhaps a little protection of the wind, but I have something else in mind. The protection from your, Jessica? Lawnmower. Protection from your lawnmower. Tree seedlings really don't like to be mowed. And in fact, what keeps your lawn lawn and not a forest is because you mow it. You didn't mow your lawn, come back in 20 years, it'd be covered in trees. That's because we live in the eastern hardwood forest where the potential vegetation is a hardwood forest. That means if we stop doing anything and let nature take its course, it ultimately reverts back to the eastern hardwood forest. So it's a good idea, as cagey gardeners, to keep our eyes out for tree seedlings and saplings that are starting to get so big that we're going to feel sorry for them, and weed them right out while they're still little and tiny and trying to grow next to our house. Ailanthus trees are particularly good at growing next to our house. If our house is built on a concrete foundation, which most of us have, because ailanthus trees really like the calcium carbonate that concrete is made out of. In fact, sometimes you can see where old homesteads used to be, and there's nothing left except field or maybe a few small trees, and growing mysteriously in a square that might not be otherwise explained is a bunch of little ailanthus, trees of heaven. If you go look carefully, spread the briars away, you can find the foundations of an old house. Trees and hedges are things that we sometimes have in our landscape. These are made of low bushes all grouped together to look like a fence. Trees and hedges, and sometimes vines, play the role of casting shade. We may want the shade. We may not want the shade. We might want the shade at certain times of year and not at other times of year. So thinking about sun and shade and where we want it or don't want it, when we want it and don't want it, is an important thing for us to be doing as landscape gardeners. Hi, Zena. So here's the sun. Here's the world. Here's the equator on the world. And the sun is going to shine on the equator straight down two times during the year. And what do we call these two times? Spring and fall what? Equinox. Spring and fall equinox. And equinox means what? Equal night. Night is equal to the day. And that happens in the spring and fall. And then in the summer and the winter, the sun goes south for the winter. Smart sun. So in the winter, the sun gets as far south as what? About how far south? Where does it go? When it goes south for the winter, where does it go? Where would you like to go? To the tropic. It goes to a southern limit that we call a tropic, and in the summertime, it goes to a northern limit that we also call a tropic. So we have two tropics. We have the southern tropic and the northern tropic. So the difference in the angle that the sun makes between the summer and the winter is about 44, 45 degrees. Now, what latitude are we at here in Ann Arbor? Does anybody know this? About 44 degrees. So, is going to make when it shines down on us is going to vary between 44 degrees plus or minus 22 degrees. So we're going to have, this is our house. In in the summertime, you're going to have about a 65 degree angle. And in the wintertime, we're going to have about a 22 degree angle. And if we have a little bit of overhang in our roof like this, in front of our big picture window, then in the winter, the sun will shine in the window, illuminate our house plants, and keep our house warm and sunny. And in the summertime, the sun won't shine in our window, so our house doesn't get too hot. Now, the same principle applies to trees and hedges and houses and any other obstruction to the sunlight that you have in your landscape. We're going to get a little tiny shadow on the north side during what season of the year? Here's our evergreen tree, and it's going to make a little tiny shadow during what season of the year, and a great big shadow during what season of the year? Little tiny shadow is the summer shadow, and the big shadow is the winter shadow. Probably if you want this tree for shade, that's just backwards, right? So, shade trees, we like shade trees to have a wide canopy that makes a shadow that's pretty much under the canopy in the summertime when the sun is shining straight down. Here's our hedge. Recall that we have basically two different ways that we can prune a hedge. And one of them we call formal, and the other one we call informal. And informal really means we let the hedge take its natural form. We let the branches of the hedge plant grow out in their natural way, often making a nice arching or flowing appearance, often taking up a lot more width around our hedge plant than if we had cut it all back. And formal means that we've artificially clipped it into a form that it would never take naturally or almost never take naturally. Now, the tradition of formal gardening might be traced back to ideas that we as Western Europeans held in our culture in the 16th and 17th century. John Milton's writings were useful for codifying these ideas, recording these ideas. I doubt seriously that he made them up. He was just writing to reflect the cultural values of the time. And at that time, it was important for people in the culture of Northwestern Europe to believe that human beings were supposed to dominate nature, that we're supposed to have dominion over nature. It was sort of our purpose. Nature had been put there for us to dominate. And the way we dominated it in those days, our concept of dominating it, was to make it grow in geometric patterns that were natural to us. We imposed our geometry onto natural plants and created formal gardens with formally pruned plants that demonstrated our superiority over the plants because we could clip them down to look like boxes, triangles, bunny rabbits, teapots, We really put them all kinds of ways here. And we still have a very strong desire, many of us, to impose our will over the plants that are growing in our garden. And of course, as gardeners, we impose our will. We get in there and interfere with all kinds of stuff that might otherwise go on if we weren't participating in it. But especially in the last decade in the United States, there's been an increased awareness of more natural gardening, an increased willingness and interest to do gardening that goes with the flow rather than tries to impose something unnatural or do something difficult or grow something exotic. We're much more interested now in growing natives in conditions that are more natural to them and celebrating that, but that's a different subject here. We still enjoy, in many parts of our landscape, formal hedges. Hedges that have been cut to look like boxes. You see that all over the place. Now let's suppose this hedge is running east and west. This is the south side, and this is the north side. And here's the sun shining. And if we cut this hedge to look like a long, skinny box, this part of the hedge here is going to get a lot of sunshine. The top of the hedge, that's going to do pretty good. But this side over here, it's going to be in the shade. And particularly, this part right down here is going to be in the shade. And even this part over here, on the sunny side, if we let this hedge do what it wants, which is grow out here at the top where it gets lots of sunshine, this down here can become in the shade too if we aren't careful with that. And when this part and this part stay in the shade for a while, what happens? Well, if those leaves can't pay their rent, the mean old landlord plant evicts them, and they fall off. So you end up with bare, sticky stems where the plant can't afford to subsidize leaves that aren't catching enough sun energy to at least maintain themselves. Now, as gardeners, we think a hedge that's got a lot of bare sticks down here at the bottom is really beautiful, right? No. So if we want to be savvy, formal hedge gardeners, then we need to give our hedge a little bit of slope coming down here. And especially the north side of the hedge, we might want to give quite a bit of slope to it, so that this part of the hedge still stands a chance of getting a little bit of light. Now you can walk through the canvas here. You can take a look through the neighborhoods of folks that have hedges. You can just look at all these hedges, all these lakey hedges, because people don't get it. Now you know how to get it, and when you grow your hedge, you'll know what to do. Hedges are like fences. What do fences do in our landscapes? Fences block the view. So if we have a view that we want to block, we can put up a fence, providing the view isn't so high that putting up a fence is not feasible. Why would we want to block a view? Might be a view of something really ugly. But it might not. We might want to block a view to more effectively present something else in front of it. And in fact, one of the really important roles that hedges play in our landscape is to provide a blank backdrop for something else
that we'd like to direct our attention to or the attention of others. So if we have a specimen plant looking very nice out there, or if we have a perennial in the narrow sense border, and we want to be able to see those flowers not just disappear off against some vague, busy background, but we want to be able to see them with our vision stop nicely on a nice green hedge, then the hedge is blocking our view, not because there's something ugly back there, but because we want our view directed at something that's in front of the hedge. Hedges and fences are also useful for dividing your landscape into areas that give us a sense of rooms. Now, we may recall that one of the ideas that's come to characterize our approach to home landscape in the latter part of this century is the idea that our landscape becomes an extension of our home outdoors. So as we extend our home outdoors, the feeling that we're in outdoor rooms can be very effective. So sometimes we can use hedges or fences to break up the space in our garden into more complex spatial structures, into places where we feel like we're in a particular spot devoted to a particular thing. The fences can also block wind, can block light and cast shade if that's what we're looking for. Although usually when we want shade, it's the summertime and we get better shade from up top than we do from a fence. The fence might block animals or people. Very often, our fences are on our property lines. When you put up a fence on a property line, it affects not only what's going on in our landscape, it affects what's going on in the landscape of your neighbor. You think your neighbor might be interested in his or her landscape? Is that likely? Likely. So when we put up a fence, or when we want to put up a fence on our property line, what would be a very good idea? Talk to your neighbor about it. In fact, getting along with your neighbor, having neighbors that you get along with, being able to figure out how to behave yourself in such a way that you do get along with your neighbor, adds enormous value to your landscape, because it enables you to enjoy your landscape with a feeling that you're among neighbors that you can get along with, rather than that you're some kind of entrenched fort in hostile enemy territory. Now, Americans in the last several decades haven't put getting along with their neighbor in a very high priority. We tend to be more concerned with our privacy than with our ability to get along with each other. There's kind of an irony in this, because so many of us now live in suburbia, which is that form of housing where we've got about six houses to a, what did we call that plot of land? Acre. An acre is how much land it takes to build six houses in suburbia. That's how we can define an acre. We live in houses that are separate with yards around them, but they're basically still pretty close to each other. You know, the reality is you'd have more real privacy if you lived in an apartment building in a city, or if you went right out there and lived in a little farmhouse in the country on a 1,000-acre farm where there wasn't any house anywhere around. That, you know, privacy is the name of the game. Those are the real options there. So in many senses, suburbia is one of the worst choices we can make if what we really want is privacy. What we really want is community. So there are some important things that we need to bear in mind when we think about our suburban landscape. One of them is
Although we don't want our neighbors looking in our bathroom window and so on, you know, there are limits. That our primary goal for our landscape is not to create or preserve or maintain privacy, although, you know, there are some limits that we want to do here. That's not the dominant goal. The dominant goal is to provide an environment outside of our house that we can use in ways that are meaningful to us, much the way we use the inside of our house. So there are some big-time no-nos that we want to bear in mind when we're looking at our landscape design. Lights in our landscape are for safety, so they illuminate your feet where you walk. A very good light for illuminating your feet where you walk is one that's right down close to the ground and can illuminate where you're walking. That way it doesn't shine in your eyes, so you still have good night vision, but it shines on the ground where your feet are going. That style of light is also excellent because another reason to have lights is for their aesthetic appeal. And of course, the real model for totally aesthetic lighting at night is what kind of light? By the light. The moonlight, right? So we're mimicking moonlight. We want to have subtle light that doesn't blast in our eyes, illuminates what we need. We may also want lights to illuminate outside activities. If we are serving a meal on our patio at night, we may need a light so our guests don't fall over their food. We may also want to put a light on our property that will help burglars see better when they're trying to break into our house. Some people like to do that. They're considerate. What we don't want to do is mount the lights on our house and shine them on our neighbor's house. A really hostile, thoughtless activity that's absolutely de rigueur in American suburbia. And similarly, sound. One man's music is another man's noise. So if you want to hear sound in your yard, put your speakers away from your patio or away from your house, aim them towards your own house, and then you can have your sound levels much lower, still enjoy them and hear them, and your neighbors hear them much less. You know, of course, the barking dog thing. You know, if you really want to have a barking dog in your yard, having your yard in suburbia is not a friendly, cooperative thing to do. So let's just bear in mind as we evaluate and admire our landscapes, we're there with a community of people that we really want to enjoy and live happily together with, and that's an important part of designing our landscapes. Please pick up your lecture quizzes from your GSI on your way out, and I hope everybody has a great spring break.